Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, come on in. Welcome to the Lawyer Henderson Podcast Radio Show. Welcome, welcome. Come on in. Yeah, come on in. All right, so today we're going to be talking about the Taraji Benjamin case. As you know, I have not been in that case since 2018 of July. Okay, have not been. I get certain types of information here and there through my own investigative work, but it's also that I get updates as far as, you know, when 2019, I remember calling the Seoul Police Department to see what was the update, and they said that they don't have nobody on the case at this moment. So that's where I last left it, you know. But, yeah, we're taking your calls here at 516-418-5867. 516-418-5867. So we're going to take some a break. We'll come back. We're going to talk about the promotion of my book and other things before we get into the conversation as to what we did right and wrong in the Taraji Benjamin's missing persons case. So come on in. Come on in. Welcome to have you. Yeah. Welcome to have you here. So let's take a quick music break here, and let's come back and get into the topic. Be right back. The Lawyer Henderson Show. The number is 516-418-5867, the call-in show to the Lawyer Henderson Show. So we're looking back at this case. You know, I went on and got into other missing persons cases and went on also to work in Oklahoma, my hometown, where Julius Jones is on death row and they were trying to even execute him. So that's what we've been focusing on is other missing persons cases, and then as far as now getting to Julius Jones and trying to do something for him to save his life so that the wicked state of Oklahoma don't execute him. Also, the new book, Political American Foolish American Politics, Let's Discuss the Issues, is out, and you can buy that wherever, you know, that books are sold. All right, so let's get into this topic, okay? So let's go back, okay? Now, I told you I have not been into Taraji's case since 2018, okay? And one of the things that, like I said, that year later, you know, like I said, called the Selma Police Department, they were engaging in a lot of, you know, reveling with police chiefs, you know. So, and out of all those police chiefs, they then just called them in and said, hey, you know, any update, what y'all doing on Taraji's case? And at that last time, they were saying that they took all of her investigative work is no more. Nobody in the Selma Police Department is working on her case the last time I've been in there. So what that means is that the case is just sitting there and there's nothing going on. Okay. That's what is happening. So now you have a situation where 2 years after, you know, stopping to do that or listening to or even calling them or, you know, no contact with the family, that's where you at. But if you look back at to what we did in the case is that we brought to light police brutality and corruption. You know, so now that you see that what we've been saying about police corruption a lot is now coming to fruition. We've been telling y'all that police corruption was happening not only in Alabama, but in Georgia, Los Angeles, California, things of that nature. You see, so now that people are finally understanding, well, what police corruption has to do with Taraji's case. Okay, well, Taraji's case involved police corruption. It always did. And it always was a situation where you don't have no one policing the police. That's the reason why you have the rioting going on now. That's the reason why you had buildings burning in Minneapolis, because people are now realizing of what we've been saying all along about how police officers can cover up a crime. So when I was investigating this young girl's case, I had looked at Bart Watkins as being this white police officer who was the overall mastermind behind her case and her trial, and that he knew certain people. And when we then went from Taraji's case and dug deep into Kanika Jenkins' case, you learned, of course, that there were certain types of similarities and cover-ups, that this case that Taraji and Kanika had together was a what we call a multi-level crime, that they will not arrest anybody, because a multi-level crime means that you have to arrest multiple people, and that has never happened in America, okay? And so that's what we tried to get people to understand in her case. And what we did right was when the Selma Police Department did not bring Mark Watkins in, they allowed him to go and work for another police agency, you see. Now you have a situation where we here in Georgia immediately called his current, supervisor from the Otago County Sheriff Department, and that's where he was brought in and questioned there. That was going to be on a documentary that we didn't complete. So you had us pretty much getting a lot of traction from that, okay? But if we would have stayed in the case today, you could have had protesters in Georgia, Minneapolis, all over, could have seen Taraji's picture, looked at the police corruption that we're dealing with now, when it relates to Breonna Taylor's case, it relates to Ahmaud Arbery. Look at all that, and here come a case where has been lingering for 10 years now. You would have seen that people would have said, okay, yeah, we have to look deeper in this young girl's disappearance case. And then we let all of this involvement of other people who did not even know the family get involved in this 2-cent gravel of conversation back and forth and let all of that be destroyed, you see. And that's the reason why I was like, okay, yeah, fine, if that's what the way you want it. All right, so we're talking about the Taraja Benjamin's missing persons case, you know, breaking my silence, of course, as you can say, after 2 years here. So after that, I kept getting calls as far as where we are at, or where we were at the case, you know. And so that's the reason why I'm doing the podcast now, because I keep having to remind people I'm no longer involved, no longer involved, no longer involved. Every call, no longer involved, no longer involved, no longer involved. That's what I've been having to tell them. So, all right, but that's how we could have done it. We could have made sure that while the police are now being confronted throughout the country by every citizen in the world, could have placed Taraja's case in back into the media spotlight. And that what could have brought on this media frenzy. Even when I met with the police chief, I told him, I said, well, you know, you get cases like Natalie Holloway, and you get these cases, they create task force, and you have family members that work with the police to, you know, keep this search going. And they did that, but it was kind of like strange when you had the National Center for Missing and Squatted Children, and I called them and talked with them, and they were did not want to talk to me to a very large extent, because I was more detailed in my questioning, you know. And the police department even asked, when we did that interview that you all see online, you know, they wanted me to write down questions. And then they had Sergeant Nilly, he kept on, you know, as I remember, my team, we were down there, and I remember how he kept on thumbing around the, you know, the buildings, I mean, not the build, the offices and stuff. He kept on coming in and out, and I'm like, man, what is he doing? Why he's asking a lot of questions that is obviously, you know, we're here to do a documentary art and, you know, to, you know, videotape, but he kept lingering. And so to see that he has, I guess, been fired for something else shows you that hell, the mayor down there at least did a good job getting rid of him, or if he, I don't know if he been reassigned. I did know that he was brought up on some charges in another case. But just by him, just by looking at the fact that, you know, when those things happen about police officers, you would see that if they don't, if they have not charged in one case, you see that they'll mess up again. And then in that particular situation, you'll always find that they are actually going to get in trouble on that other thing. So I'm glad that Sergeant Nilly was arrested, because I've also said throughout the case, when I was there in it, involved in the case for between 2011, okay, Taraja went missing June 26, 2010. So I got involved, or we got involved on in July of 2011 to 2018. So you've seen how, you know, Neely and all these other cops are that was investigating the case, they're no longer even working in the investigations unit, because it was kind of like, you know, the city should have been, or the people should have been looking at their investigation unit. Their investigation unit at the time that William Riley was the police chief was too corrupt. That's the reason why when they brought in the FBI, when they were stealing all those guns from the you know, what they call it, the you know, where they placed the evidence room, they were having these white people stealing all these guns, and they were selling the evidence and stuff like that. So that thing, you know, I was looking at as well, when we were investigating this case, I said, man, this police department is getting away with a lot of things. They're, you know, down there doing things that if you know, that people are not understanding, you know, the drugs and stuff that, you know, that some of them getting paid on the back end on. So I said, I knew there was something that Tarasha even said or she mentioned, or there's something that was pretty much going on by her being with her boyfriend, and how it was like, man, she was exposed to a lot of things there that they did not want her to see. I've always maintained that the Selma Police Department, even if you look at Bart Watkins, remember when we did that investigation with him, and I was on the phone with the Tugger County Sheriff's officials. And one of the things that I told them is that, well, you know, in two cities where Bart Watkins was a police officer, you know that he was, you know, either, you know, involved in this missing girls case. And then when he was in Marengo County, they fired him there for almost a similar situation. So no one cannot say that we were not right about him being the mastermind behind Taraji's disappearance. That has always been there. No one could say that it has changed over the years. So we got our mastermind behind her case. You know, we have our, you know, we had him, okay? And then they were about to then, you know, they were investigating him in Marengo County. But at that time, you know, while working with the police there in Marengo County, they were asking us to try to find some evidence that they can arrest him on the other situation that went on in Marengo County. But unfortunately, he got he had like a lot of people, you know, that helped him. And I believe that's where the people from the Selma Police Department came in, like Sergeant Millie. I believe like the confiscating her Regina's computer and things of that nature, how they took that computer and had the hardware, the hard drive, you know, that could have had evidence in it. So they were doing all this stuff that I was like, man, we were shocked that it really had a lot of things that could have revealed of who she was emailing the day she went missing. So I brought a different strategy here. We brought a different strategy that was not being explored by this police department. And so we wanted to know why they were being so secretive. You know, that's one of the reasons why we were so interested in her case from the outstar. So you get these kinds of situations. And even with Kanika Jenkins, you've seen how the police officers in her case, you see how they had like record numbers of videos where when she was stumbling down the stairs and stuff, that they gave her some kind of medication or something to throw off her mentality. That typically what happens in these cases. And so just by looking at Kanika's case and seeing how quickly she was found in that freezer shows you that, you know, it's a lot of corruption that was being exposed at that time, you know, because, you know, it was like, man, so no one could not tell us that police officers were not involved in those cases. Or the hotel in her situation was that the hotel itself was engaged in a lot of, you know, crazy ritual type stuff. You know, they had all kinds of stuff that were going on in that hotel. They had body parts. And so the FBI did raid the area where the body parts was being at one warehouse, a factory there. When they raided the factory, they saw all these bones and all these bodies there. So then the morgue or what have you, or whatever they call it, the medical examiner's office was moved from that location, and then it was put together in the police department. So you see how that they covered up her case, you know. So just by looking at Kanika Jenkins' case and then Taraji's case, you know, there is certain similarities. So that's the reason I was like, man, this was really catching and eyeballing. This was really something that we could have put on film. Okay, so that's what I you know, look back on a case about. Another thing I want to talk to you about was the social media campaign that was going on with her case, which media is very important in missing persons cases, and so is money. People think that they can just go and say, hey, you know, you don't need those two important things. Social media, you know, Taraji's case, I think, was on Mari. You know, they did reruns, but that's not enough. You need a campaign on social media. That social media campaign, by far, in my opinion, would have grown to national media again and would have brought her case to light. But the Van Viper family got involved and just screwed up everything, because I was also investigating that dude on that Facebook page, and he was also linked to another crime. And so I did apologize to him on One Accord, because I thought that, you know, that he was involved in Taraji's case, but it came to find out that he was involved in another case where a white female came forward and described that gentleman into that situation. So I said, okay, he's not Edward Van. And that was prior to, you know, Regina taking us off the case, where we found that out. And so this guy who was from the Coast Guard, we called him and said that we made that correction. But we did not say that he was innocent, because he's not. So the fact is that we believe that we've solved, or almost about to solve, two cases at one time, where we've seen or even gave a picture out to this young lady, and she pretty much was like, okay, yeah, send me that picture of this guy. And so I was like, okay, we sent the picture, and she's like, yeah, that looked like the guy who was trying to, kidnap me. So when she said that, you know, that happened in a part of Alabama as well. So we put the two cases together. We found out that they were not related. They wasn't related, but we found out that, you know, he could have been a suspect in another attempt on a young girl's abduction. So the Van Viper family tried to protect him because he was married in the family. And so that, and like I said, it's all good. I, you know, when we get involved in anything, it's pretty much at the mercy of the family. Like in Julius Jones' case, in which we're working on now, his sister is the main one speaking out. She's wanting all kind of help from us and other people. So we'll be at, like I said, we'll be at the mercy of Mr. Jones' case, based upon the fact of what his sister need from us. My hometown is Oklahoma, so when we go down there, you know, she will pretty much tell us what she wants us to do for her brother. Her brother's on death row, so they know that, you know, everything that we do, we're going to connect with them. We're going to go down there, and we're going to see how we can help, whether we need to pass out flyers, any of those things, you see, and, you know, travel if we need to. And that's exactly what we're trying to do in Taraji's case. But I think it's too many family members there that when you get involved in a missing persons case, you've got to have certain people who just needs to be quiet, really. Just literally need to be quiet, because when you have a missing person, just like Taraji's case, and you got all these family members or even people who claim to be kin to you, you know, it creates a lot of confusion. And then you think that you're helping, but you're really not. You're really just helping to destroy the campaign. And that's what we've seen in Taraji's case. I am not going to, you know, say that I did a lot of things wrong. I think one of the most important things that I did wrong was to continue to post and post and post. And as you've seen, I did not respond to no post when we were doing the update here in her 10-year anniversary. So that's one of the most important failure in my opinion. So I believe, though, that when this case first happened in June 26, 2010, you know, we were, you know, we had, you know, a lot of information we were gathering. We had notes. We had met with Regina and her family. And I met with Pam at the, I remember, first in Montgomery. So this Van Riper family, they didn't know any of them. They didn't know anybody. Okay. I came down there, you know, and the first thing I did, as she, you know, is hug Regina, because I know how it feels to lose a person. I lost my mom, I lost my dad. And I know how it feels to lose a person. That is really a emotional drain on you. So I understood, you know, but we have always been in our organization at the mercy of the family. We've never, ever stopped that. Like I said, when I got into Troy Anthony Davis case, we were at the mercy of his sister and his mom. You know, they said, hey, we need you to show up at this rally, pass out flyers, and we did that. Same thing in Janella Wilson's case when we spoke out at the 11th Circuit outside and the media was there. I was on CNN radio and we were talking about his case. We did it at the mercy of the family. So anytime that a family said, we don't need you no more, that's it. We're gone. We're done. Okay. And I can reflect back on Taraji's case because it's a missing persons case. And one of the things that I've done since then was also assist two other families and told them, hey, this is what you need. You get a petition out there, try to get them into the media, try to pass out flyers as much as you can. And, you know, I looked at some information about like how the white American media, how they, you know, pastor these white girls on television. And when you come to a black person, it's like we get no media attention. And I talked about that. And we did a whole interview about that on some radio station here in Georgia, whereas that they have been killing black folks for their organs. They have been, you know, trapping or killing black folks for certain types of organs in our bodies, you know, because, you know, they pretty much know that, you know, black people are strong as far as their organs. So we've had a lot of black people go missing because of organ harvesting. And a lot of black people don't understand that. They think that, oh, it's some relative or some boyfriend or some husband or some girlfriend. They think that that, you know, it's just some family member that is involved into these missing persons cases. No, the vast majority of black missing people in this particular situation is through has been missing because of being kidnapped with, you know, because of their organs. They're not being kidnapped because somebody lured them away. They've been kidnapped because of organs or because they had seen something that the police did or some other type of high-profile politician or somebody did, and to cover up the case, they often then will, you know, go in and have the person kidnapped. So it's, you know, when you see on the news and stuff, when they talk about, you know, human trafficking, and they say, oh, well, this black dude, he was in the hotel with two underage girls, and the police is getting real strict on human trafficking. You know, even though that dude is wrong for doing that and he should be in jail, but that's not human trafficking. Human trafficking in America goes deeper than that. It goes deeper than that. Human trafficking in some parts, as I told you and explained to you in Taraji's case, they had to then set this girl up to get her to a location where they can take her and snatch her. It's not a situation where you just look at someone and you know, say, okay, yeah, I can go and snatch that person up. Most likely, you know, you have a plan to do that. You have some kind of, you know, idea. Like when they looked at Talisha's truck and you've seen how the windows were covered in plastic, for instance, you know that they planned that the day before that she went missing. There's no way that you can have these two windows missing from the SUV, and that's not a situation of of saying, man, why is these cup covered with plastic? You know, you got to understand that, you know, that was a setup. It cannot be anything different, you know, than a setup, you see. So that being the case, it's almost like they knew that, hell, if they couldn't force her out of the car, you know, or get her out of the car with a will, they knew that, you know, well, we're going to have to snatch her out of the windows or something like that. So that's the reason why those two windows was removed. And then on top of that, you know, you had Talisha lying by claiming that all she did was allow, you know, Taraja to use her car. You know, she was lying. And then a lot of questioning, like even when like we was in a case, you saw how we were questioning the other two girls that were at the home. Okay, and it's like nobody, if you know, we were all young before, you know, nobody, and even I had people call me up and say, and they said, you know, lawyer, nobody, you know, say, hey, I'm going to stay with your mom, and I'm not going to go with my homegirl to the flea market. Nobody does that. What homegirls or homeboys you know that did not jump into a vehicle with their homegirl or homeboy? That just don't happen. So that's the reason why I wanted to question Mimi again. And so she began to get offended by just me having follow-up questions. So I felt that was also strange. Another thing is that, like I said, when you have everyone telling or giving their opinions into this particular case, it's all but gossip, but it never gets to, like I said, no point where you strategize, you know, you bring media, like I said, media outlets, okay? There's no real organization there. And people was looking at this on this case. Like I said, we did our social media campaign back in June of 2018. We reached 20,826 people on that day, okay? Now where is all those people at? They're not listening about Taraja's case now, but they could have been had we removed ourselves away from this petty argument and going back and forth crowd to just, you know, a lot of times, you know, you have, and I was just, when I first came on just a moment ago, I was looking in at listening to Natalie Holloway's case, and then there was another young white girl that went missing. And in both of those cases, you had, you know, all kinds of people calling Natalie Holloway a drunk, calling her a whore, calling her all kinds of things. You don't worry about what those people say about your daughter, because the ideal is that you're wanting that press. You're not focusing on what you call. If I had children and my kids were missing, hell, you can call my daughter all kinds of whores. The bottom line is I want to know where she is. You know, that's the bottom line. And you focus on what the leads are going to get happening and not the naysayers who's just wanting attention for themselves. And that's what it was all about. And so you had people who just didn't have anything to do who interrupted our campaign. And that's just what bottom line. Based upon wanting to get heard, didn't have anything better else to do, and, you know, just wanted to just be messy. And that's going to happen. And so, and like I said, it's different when a black person go missing versus a white person. You know that the white person is going to have the father out there. They're going to have the mother out there. Unfortunately, Taraja's father died a year or so later, which is also suspicious. And when we were investigating the case, we were investigating her father's case because that was also suspicious of how he was just found dead behind a building. So we pretty much look at certain types of of how these families and missing person cases are actually how they, you know, deal with stress of their missing loved ones. And no one said that you have to, you can't be emotional, but the focus has to always be find my loved one, okay? this police department is not doing anything for Tarasha. They're not going to, because in a sense, then, when, like I said, when most police officers, and I spoke with a police chief that was in Mississippi. He actually was about to come down there to Selma with us when we went down there to meet with the family and police. He said it. He said most police chiefs and other people, they would actually resign if it takes of covering up a case or crime. Okay, they were pretty much will put their 2 weeks notice in, and they'll go find another department to go run, only to keep evidence from getting out about a missing person case or whatever happened to a specific crime. So we've seen all of that in Tarasha's case, you know. And it's like, you know, you don't really want to be accusatory, but you all often have to just say, okay, something's not adding up with, you know. So we did all of that. And so when we start to look at Bart Watkins as being the mastermind, number one, they said that this man didn't work into the investigations unit. So we knew that, oh, it was something weird about him. So then when he went to Marengo County and I spoke with the police agencies down there, you know, again, and this would have been in a documentary as well, but they told me all kinds of things, like this guy was weird. Like when he was in a patrol car, he would talk about these types of cases that be on 48 hours and stuff. You're like, wow. So he was strange in that regard. So when they fired him or did not elect him to become, again, the sheriff deputy a second time, he found a job in Otega County. But let me just tell you before I go into that, why he found that job in Otega. So Bart Watkins had a brother who was a city attorney. And when your family members engage in corruption, crime, and stuff like that, and your brother, your siblings, or somebody in your family is an attorney, Bart Watkins' father and his family all were managers and vice presidents and owners of banks, and you had a sorry police officer like him, who the father of the Watkins did not trust him to run the business. That's the reason why, as far as him coming on late, as far as being into the family business, was almost at the time that his father died. So when he finally created this business, Watkins Enterprise, in which Edward Van's name came up, because Edward had came down to Alabama or one of those, you know, to do security work for him. That's the reason why we knew about Edward Van at that point. So now we had that connection, you know, that who would have been one of the people to meet up with Chris Dukes down in Sardis? It would have been Edward Van. It would have been, because he had the knowledge and information about Tarasha, we believe, through Bart Watkins. So that information was not wrong. It's just that we identified the wrong police, guy in the wrong situation. So I think that that's one of the biggest mistakes that we did there. Keep in mind that, like I said, when you know that police officers involved, if they're taking somebody off the case, you know that somebody's involved, that it's police officer or law enforcement. Okay, it's not going to be, it has to be somebody. It's going to be someone in law enforcement. Because by taking the police officer off the case shows you that they don't want nobody investigating. This is the case you got to leave alone, okay? So if you think just somebody average did this, oh, you got another thought coming, okay? Look, you cannot have one or two people setting up a young girl and then getting her out of the city, and then you go and look for a suspect who she just met around the corner. That's foolish, you know? Believe in that. It's not serious police work, and they understand that. You know, that's not serious police work. What you have to understand is that there was already a campaign against him. Now, let me just tell you about the Tucker County Sheriff's investigation that was conducted with Mark Watkins. In fact, I was on the phone when they called him in for questioning. And one of the first things that he had said was, and I knew that this is the reason why he was involved, is because he's working at another agency at the time that he got information on Taraji's case. I mean, who does that? So that's one of the biggest reasons why we know that he was involved. Second reason here is that when they came and investigated, well, they brought him into the, you know, the talk to him, you know, Bart Watkins had called me back real quick before the investigation was really lingering. And we talked for a while. So people were asking, not the family, but people that, you know, were supporting Taraji had asked me, did you have a conversation with Bart Watkins? I said, of course I did. Absolutely. Because you don't learn about a person who's guilty until you speak with them. Okay. You know, we could tell that Talisha was scared because this young girl was not on the phone with us for about, she was on the phone with us, I think, for like 5 minutes. And she hurried up and got off when I started asking her questions. So I knew at that time that when they had the vehicle, I knew that they were like, you know, that they had told her to bring her vehicle over there so they can remove those windows just like that. So it was not a situation where they even had to break out the window because, like I said, it was covered with plastic. So all they had to do if they needed to snatch her out was rip off the windows. They didn't have to do that here. And the reason why they didn't have to do that with it, because number one, she didn't drive that vehicle back to the bypass. If you look at the evidence and if you look at crime reconstruction, that tell you that they didn't have to snatch her out of the vehicle. That vehicle was driven back to the bypass by, I think, Chris Duke's friends. So now you have a situation where the whole entire case was really, really interesting because now she jumps into the car, in our opinion, with Christopher Dukes, and then drives to Sardi. So now at that point, you know that she was already out the city. You didn't go to the flea market. We know that as well. So that right there shows you that we were on the right track as far as her steps prior to leaving Selma to go to Sardis. And of course, I interviewed Chris. In fact, his family members wanted me to have dinner with them. And they were already up here, and I was in my office. And they were already there. They were like, they were asking me curiously as to why he was the only suspect. And I told his sister or his niece or whatever. I said, no, he's not the only suspect. But they invited me to dinner when they were here in Atlanta. And I remember talking to his niece, Christopher Duke's niece. He said that Taraji comes over sometimes. And he would see her coming over to certain places. And so I said, well, it was strange because he told me he didn't know her. So that kind of stuff, it was kind of like something said at 1 minute and then something was said different at another minute. So that's the reason why we stayed interested in the case, because it was all these twists and turns. But we never, ever got to the fact that if she did travel outside Alabama, that's why I think we stopped that. I think we pretty much did not see another pattern, you know. I mean, we talked about Maryland, we talked about Washington, and those are the places where Edward Van had stayed. In fact, I believe Bart Watkins and Edward Van had met down in Maryland, you know, and the evidence shows that. The evidence shows that Bart Watkins hired this gentleman, Edward Van. I got evidence of that right now. Okay, we've compiled a whole folder of Taraji's case, where we had evidence that he hired Edward Van. In fact, Edward put his on his resume. It shows you that he said that he worked for Watkins Enterprise, which is owned by Bart Watkins, the former police officer working in some police department. So we knew they knew each other. There was no accident about that. We knew that they knew each other. So, and Edward had access to a police squad car or a security car that may have looked like a police car, you know. So we had all of that information. We were not blindsided by any imagination on that regard. That was really evidence that we had in Taraja's file here. So that was the situation. Now, as far as having the state police and the FBI involved in her case, I remember just like yesterday that the chief down there, William Riley, before he resigned, he was so anxious to even get me his suspects that he didn't want me calling the state police. He was like, okay, I said, well, can I get the, he said that they were arrested by the state police. I said, okay, I'll call them and get your, the people that you say are the suspects in her case. And he said, no, I'll get that for you. Just give me a minute. So he sent me a picture of these two guys that was staying in Selma. I mean, just looking at them and investigating them, you know, along with Chris Harris besides him, I knew that, you know, they couldn't pull off something huge like this. It has to be something that was real. Now, let me tell you why I suspect Bart Watkins, and you're going to, you know, you have to understand this, okay? Bart Watkins admitted that he had arrested Taraja at a local Walmart, okay? And by him not, you know, putting that in on the radar or even, you know, calling that in, something was suspicious about that. I mean, if you arrested a young girl, number one, you're supposed to call a female officer to pat her down. That's number one. He did none of that, but he revealed that he had arrested her. So for shoplifting at a Walmart is what he told the Tugger County Sheriff's officials, his boss at the time. I don't know if he still worked there because, like I said, I'm not investigating this no more. But he had told them that, hey, I've arrested her, and that's the only contact that I made with her. And we were like, okay, well, where's the paperwork on that, you know? And they don't, still today, they don't know if they have paperwork on that particular situation. But I know that's what he told us over the phone. So we all had our own phone conference while they brought him in, and so he started to say all that. So we knew that, man, this man, and then at the end of the conversation, oh, man, they were ruthless towards us. They said, well, Mr. Henderson, I see your evidence, but even if he did it, is what they said, even if he did it, they told me you don't have the forensic evidence. And hung up on me. I was like, damn. So I knew that was like really crazy, man. They were like, even if he did it, you don't have the forensic evidence. And they were right, because that's where the Selma Police Department came in. I believe that they had Millie and all these other cops cover up the evidence so that we couldn't have the information that we needed in order to get him arrested. So that was the really what happened. Like I said, this was a multi-level crime. And in a multi-level crime, no one goes to jail, because the fact of the matter is that, you know, you have a lot of people involved. That's number one. And number two, you know, people who are typically involved in a multi-level crime is typically friends of the police. These are people that police officers go out in the hood, and they are their so-called quote-unquote informants, or their COs, what they call COs or whatever. And these are people who knows the streets, and the police officers often go to them to get their information, to get all kinds of things. They go to their COs to get those people. These people are the ones who knows everybody on the street, but who works with the police as far as corruption, because the police, of course, as I explained to you, are corrupt. So when they come to the streets, they go after those CEOs who is going to give them the information on the streets and who is going to keep their flow of drugs or whatever going on. So you know that in this particular case, it almost was looking like that as well. So we were looking at every angle here. We were looking at every angle. So I think we only made a few mistakes. We really didn't make a lot, and those mistakes could have made it, could have been corrected. I mean, you know, it was not really anything that was real huge. So that was really the most important thing to be said here, looking back on her case, looking back at what we've done. And so it's a shame that, like I said, you have now that everybody sees about police corruption. It's not just about shooting and killing black people or what they've been doing all the time. It's also about killing us for our organs, and that's exactly what they've done. Or for them not to be arrested for a crime themselves, they often, like I said, will set you up and have you murdered and killed. So it's a lot of angles that we can go on the case if you want to play that game. You know, it's not, you know, rocket scientists to narrow down two or three points into the case. It's really very easy, you know. One of the things that happened in Kanika Jenkins' case is when we looked into her case, you saw that, like I said, they gave her all kinds of medication that had pretty much threw off her mentality and threw her off as far as her balance, and she was just, like I said, bumping into walls. So when they mix all these medicine and other types of things to you and you drink that stuff, you know, it's like you're really quickly in a daze. You're really out. And then you add that with other types of alcohol or what have you. You're really out on that. So when they seen her, so like I said, when she was in that freezer and they claimed that she took off her clothes because she was in I forget the word they described that she had, but not all her clothes was off. What was said about it is that, you know, she was pretty much from the cold air that she was reacting to that. And, you know, it's like, no, you looked at the video and the pictures, you will see that her clothes was just pulled down as if she was just got finished being raped. You see, you don't have any evidence that, you know, she took off her clothes because of the frozen air. And then you look at the pictures, it shows something totally different. And you see how the police corruption in her case in Chicago, how they, you know, tried to come out and say that, you know, that she died from hypothermia is what it was called. I'm like, man, come on. This police department is corrupt. They're using all kinds of ways to cover up a crime here. And that's the reason why we've been asking, even at the Atlanta protest in which we participated in, we said, you know, the question was, who policed the police? And that's the reason why we are upset. That's the reason why, like I said, that you have burning buildings all across the country, because so many people, there's black people who put their faith in the police oftentimes, and especially the ones who align with the system. They put their faith in the police, and the police is crooked. You got to understand, they pretty much are not going to solve cases that's going to get them in trouble, okay? So that's the reason why no one is on the case, okay? But then when you start to explain that, you know, someone who is from the outside looking in, when you don't have, you know, history and culture and the history of the police and history of what all of this back and forth of these white race soldiers killing us and abusing us, and you don't know the history of that in your own culture and history, then you look at somebody who's telling you that, and then I become the enemy, you see. That has always happened when we talk about this. So, you know, and I don't have that kind of patience, you know, just to be placed in a situation where I'm putting my life on the line just to help someone, and it's not been appreciated. That was fine. So, but when you look at how the case is going, you're going to see, as like I said, the police is not going to investigate it. In fact, it was us who called the state police and the FBI. She has a profile. Taraja has a profile with the FBI that nobody knew about, but we called them and said, look, you got to put her information inside your database. And so a lady down there said, okay, well, we need information from you. And I said, sure. So we sent the FBI information, okay? But when you have a situation where the FBI or the state police or the police agency, when it comes to them as far as investigative work, they're not going to do it if they know that another police officer or somebody who they know is engaged in corruption. They're going to put and sweep that under a rug. And that's what the Southern Police Department did with Taraja's case. They swept it under the rug. And then when we got involved, they said, oh, damn, here come, you know, what is this? These people going to uncover? And then on top of that, they didn't think it was going to go to the Martin Povich show. So I was looking online and I was seeing that Chief Riley, he was already ready to resign, not probably because of Taraja's case, but he knew that he was up against a lot of stress. When a young girl goes missing and he has a lot of, you know, pressure to find out who did it and all these kind of things, and you don't want to side with the, well, you want to side with the police and then you want to side with the public, but you resign or you try to find a way to get the hell out of there because you don't know whose side to go on. So I felt, you know, that he was under pressure with having to decide that. I understand that because, like I said, with this other police chief I talked to, that really would drive a person crazy where, you know, you got to pick and choose between, you know, saving your officers, not getting them terminated, you know, not, you know, having an overhaul in the whole police agency versus, okay, the public is demanding this, they're demanding that, they're demanding you better, you know, why we hired you for it, we are paying you these dollars, X amount of dollars. So he was put into that rut. And so in a sense then, oh, in order to get out of that rut, you're gonna resign if you don't get fired. Do something to get fired. You're gonna resign. Okay. So that happened, and like I said earlier, police chiefs often resign because they don't want to uncover certain things that happen in the case that they pretty much was involved in or worked in prior to, you know, any situation of them leaving. They will resign. They won't stick around in a city where they're being questioned about certain things, you know. Now, like I said, it was I got into the case. Okay, so Taraja went missing June 26, 2010. We got into the case July of 2011 and left in 2018. So now you have, what, this is 10 years. So 2 years, you know, I stayed quiet because it was not really anything for me to do after that. But, you know, I just wanted to, you know, to say my side of the story. It is not really no hard feelings. I mean, like I said, I allow Regina to make the decisions, and it's no hard feelings. I mean, if I see her on the street, I'm going to give her a hug because, like I said, you know, she lost a daughter. So it's no hard feelings. I have no regrets of what I've done in our case. In fact, like I said, this Van Riper family, they're, I mean, I kept investigating now because, like I said, they were a corrupt family. And one of the things that I recognize about them is that, man, they pretty much had this dude that they were protecting. Man, he went and he started to dye his hair when I called him out. And when I showed that picture to that other girl who said that he tried to rape her or kidnap her, he started to dye his hair and all kinds of stuff. So that family was corrupt, and that's the reason why I kept his picture on the page. And so it was like, man, yeah, every time that I get information of someone trying to kidnap somebody, I'm going to plaster their picture online. I'm not going to sit and allow them to get away with kidnapping anybody. No, okay? our job, you know, when we talked about trying to protect people and children, everyone who is engaged in the criminality, they have to be exposed, and that's what we did. And so it did come to find out that he was not involved in Taraji's case, but he was involved in another. I was investigating two cases. I didn't know that at that time. So when I started to dig into Taraji's case, he became a suspect, and then found out that he did some other things and someone could identify him for kidnapping them. And I was like, oh, man. But learned that these were not the same people. So, yeah, that mistake we did make. And we apologized in that end. And I've always regretted that. But we didn't apologize, you know, to the certain extent that he was not out there doing crimes, because he was as well. So I think that we were in solving two cases at the same time here. And I let this guy from the Coast Guard know that, you know. And so he started, like I said, to dye his hair and do all kinds of crazy stuff just to throw off and say, oh, you're blaming somebody from the U.S. Coast Guard. We was not talking about the brother of them. We were talking about a married person in the family. This guy was a married person in the family. He wasn't in the Coast Guard. His brother-in-law was. And so people just started to just get upset. And you know how white people, a lot of them, not all, but a lot of them like to lie. That's the reason why we're dealing with problems and issues right now. Like here in Georgia, for instance, we told all the white people they had to go because they were burning down McDonald's in our neighborhoods. They were burning down the Wendy's. You know, they just arrested a white girl for doing that. So when we talk like that, and, you know, it's like sometimes, you know, they come in to start trouble. And that's what we were doing. We were trying to get them out the way because they're going to come in and start trouble. They're going to come in, not all, but a lot of them come in and they start trouble. So that's the reason why when we did the Atlanta protest, we were out there, we had to get rid of all the white supremacists out there because they were throwing rocks and stuff at the National Guard. And so that could get us killed. So we had to say, hey, you race soldiers, y'all got to get the hell up out of here because y'all starting trouble. And so, and that's what I wanted the Benjamin family to understand, that we brought race soldiers in and they're here to start trouble. So, and like I said, you know, some people get it, some people don't. Okay, so that's the reason why we wanted them out the way, and we went back and forth. We said nothing about Taraji. We were back and forth with them because they were engaging all kinds of white supremacist rhetoric. Okay, so when you look at that, and now people are starting to realize that certain race soldiers are out here, and they will try to then undermine a movement. And that's what they tried to do here in the Atlanta protest, undermine the black movement where we are rising up against police corruption and brutality. And we've been saying this about police corruption for years. In fact, when we were doing Taraji's case, we uncovered that there was places in Alabama where these police officers and correctional officers was having sex with the female inmates at the county jail. A lot of them was accused of sexual harassment and stuff. We started to uncover a lot of stuff going on in Alabama, Georgia, Florida. It was going on rapidly back in 2011, but that's where people were basically, they were very naive about what was going on in police corruption. And now, so that when the world see that after George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and all these other people start to get killed at the hands of police violence, now you have all cases coming to light saying, oh, man, yeah, and the police did this, and the police sexual harassed me here. And, you know, so that's what we're saying. We wasn't wrong. We were just pretty much should have not been active towards the public as more. And that's what one of the police department officers said. It says you don't deal with the public and give them information every time, because they're going to run with it, they're going to shape their own kinds of stuff with it, and it's not going to work for you, okay? And that's a lesson that I had to learn, you see. Mm-hmm. So other than that, so that was a kind of a situation there, you know. So, but it was a situation here. I wanted to play the thing. I mean, a lot of y'all seen that I did. I was down there and I interviewed the police department, the police officers as well. And like I said, that they wanted me to have questions already written for them. They didn't want questions that was just coming off the tab, because you know one question will lead to another interesting questions, you see. So I was going to see if I could, well, a lot of you can go on and see the interview that I did with the police department. So let's see. Let me take a real, real brief music break here so I can find this audio clip that I wanted y'all to hear, if I can find it. If I can't, then I will just go over it briefly here. Let's see here. Let's see. All right. Let's, yeah, so, But I mean, y'all can still call in if you want. I will answer your questions. I'm not going to shy away from answering your questions. I mean, like I said, I'm a person on the outside looking in. I have no problem with that. But let's see. So yes, but yeah, it's the 10th anniversary. Like I said, we're focusing on Julius Jones right now, because he's about to be executed by the crooked system in Oklahoma. So we're working with his sister on trying to get him clemency, because he's in jail for a crime he did not commit. And you know how they've been railroading the system with us. They've been railroading the system with us. They've been, you know, playing all kinds of evidence against black people for years. You all know that. They have been, this one brother, for instance, he had been framed in his business in California. And so if he had like a videotape to show that these race soldiers were planting all kinds of weed and evidence into his business. So we know how corrupt the police are. No one is not going to be naive to understand the police corruptions there. No one is going to be naive on that. You know, police officers were already you know, like I said, Tori Nelly, they already said, oh, we're going to stop the Amber Alert for her. You know, they said that in a matter of days, you know, just to not have focus on her. So they pretended like they were going to do all these things for her, and they were not. You know that. And so, we're doing that. Oh no, I shouldn't be playing that. Alright, so hold on, I'm sorry. Alright, so the petition online, let's talk about that a little bit. Okay. Moveon.org. Okay. I wanted to ask the question here about the situation. So my thing was, okay, is that prior to leaving Taraji's case, we've asked for the police report, okay? We acknowledge that Regina's brothers had went down to ask the district attorney for the police for money from the Governor Ivey. And prior to that, I had called Governor Ivey's office and asked them, where they're going to put up a $5,000 reward money. They did agree to that. But like I said, the police report was never handed to the district attorney, and I had asked for a police report. That was never given to us. And let me tell you about on a state level, they give more reward money if someone come forward, and then also it brings the state police involved as well. That was never done in Taraji's case. It was attempted, but was never done. That was going to be the next step. It would have been that the reward money would have came from state of, you know, and like I said, someone would have called and said, hey, I got some information, and they would have, you know, was able to collect that reward money had that led to some real evidence. So even on our petition that we've done for her, you know, we outlined the ways into which this case could have gotten very much strategic investigative work. You know, like I said, by calling the district attorney and calling the NAACP, because they would have been hopefully interested in finding out that, you know, that it was a white cop involved, that he was also fired from another police agency and they investigated him. That would have been something that could have gotten these organizations' attention. It could have really spread out to a statewide investigation, you know. And so those were the techniques that, you know, that we put on a petition into which I was trying to organize, you know, for Taraji's case. It was really a very important role as well to have the U.S. Department of Justice, because if the police, as we see now, you know, sometimes the state police and the local police, they don't do their job, as you see, then you have to go to the national level to try to get some justice. And like I said, this is a multi-level crime. It's hard to investigate a multi-level crime because, like I said, it involves so many people. And unfortunately, Taraji's case is a multi-level crime. So it involves so many folks that did a lot of things in her case where, hell, if this person don't say nothing, that person's going to stay quiet, this person's going to stay quiet, and then the situation just continue. And so that's how they do it when police officers are involved and they corrupt the situation. They're gonna reach out, like I said, to somebody who they know in the streets, and they're going to engage in a multi-level crime. And so, like, that's what we saw in Tamika Jenkins' case. We saw a multi-level crime. And that multi-level crime is very hard to really solve. And in her case, in Tamika's case, yeah, you're right. She did die in the case, in that situation. But at the same time, you see how the hotel were covering up evidence. You see how the police was there and they brought in the they were saying that her, and I even got the medical examiner report. I had got that, and they were saying that her thymus gland was missing. After the police report, her thymus gland was missing. So they were actually cutting her open already, taking her body parts, and she had not even went to the morgue or the medical examiner office yet. They were already, you know, cutting out, you know, bones and stuff like that. And they do that to our bodies. They, you know, there's, like I said, there's another case, same thing in Florida, same thing in Georgia, here in Georgia. Same thing, you know, the killing of organs, and one brother's body got stuffed with newspapers. So if you see that, and they do this because they can make, on the black market, they can make thousands and thousands of dollars off in the selling of body parts, okay? And I'm not saying that happened to Taraji. I'm just letting you know how certain types of corruption by police could happen, especially when they go missing and they stage a crime scene. And so that's what we see. We see a staging of a crime scene in Taraji's case, you know? Like I said, I'm not saying that, you know, they killed her for her organs. It's a possibility, but I'm saying
We saw those in different cases. Wow. Someone's trying to... Sorry there. So I was trying to call in. I'll call me. Hold on. Yeah, but we see that in the cases where if they choose you out in a specific place or what have you, they will stage a crime scene and you know, will kill you for your organs. We have a lot of other cases of people went missing and they have been found dead, their organs missing, all kinds of evidence of foul play, and then the police will say, oh, we have no evidence, and we'll get back with you, and, you know, it's been 20 years later, and there's no new leads in the case, and so that's how, you know, you see, and you look directly at the investigation, and you see how they are even, you know, manipulating the evidence in the case, and it's like, no, this is problematic, so... So that was one of the things that you should be looking at. Like I said, in this petition, we really wanted to lay out the framework. In fact, some of this stuff we did as well. We had asked the ABI. In fact, I was on the phone with the ABI. The ABI is your state police of Alabama. And we had asked them, well, they're going to create a task force for her. And they said, yeah, you know, we'll create one for her. They thought at first that I was representing Regina as an attorney. And so I remember them saying, yeah, we'll create a task force to go look for her. And I said, okay, that's good. That's good because that's great. And they got back with me like 2 weeks after claiming that they were going to create the task force and then determined that, oh, no, you need to call back the Selma Police Department. And we were like, well, why call them back? You know, they the reason why we called y'all, you know. And they was like, well, somebody said that they were trying to get surgery on their knee. I'm like, well, who? I was like, what? You know, so they had canceled the task force to go and search. I'm like, really? Just because someone's about to do surgery on their knee, you cancel her task force? And then I asked them, I said, well, when are you going to be thinking about creating a task force after whoever this person, this police officer, and the Selma Police Department who needs to get his knee replaced, if that's most important? And they said, well, we're not going to be able to ask no more questions for you. And it's like, man, I was like, wow. So when they told me that I have to call back the Selma Police Department and actually were pretty much asking them about the task force, for Tarasha, and now you got that limbo situation, I was like, okay, I knew that this was some crazy stuff going on here. So that's what happened with the ABI task force situation. Now, remember, well, you probably don't remember, but Dr. Benway would have told you that Bart Watkins used to work for, he got his training done at the Otaga County Sheriff's Official. That's exactly where he's done training, and so did the people who worked around him who were, quote-unquote, from the state police. So they all knew each other. They were all in cahoots with each other back in the 2011 when we first got into the case. So we knew that these police officers was all buddy-buddy friends and stuff like that, but, you know, they went fishing with each other and all that kind of stuff. So they're not going to solve a case that's going to put one of them in jail. Hey, I'm going to, oh, you know, you be working, you know, you be in the river fishing with them and say, well, what, you're in the suspect in a missing girl's case. No, they're going to take you take their friend in for being involved? No, you know, they're not going to do that, you know. So they were all buddy-buddy together. They were basically in cahoots with each other. So when you have a buddy system like that, you're not going to get no case. you're not going to have no real investigation. That's not going to happen. You understand? Because they create a brotherhood. And then when you look at the fraternity of police, they are all white. They mostly speak like white supremacists. So just imagine saying, hey, I want justice for my black daughter or my black son. It takes a whole media protest and burning down buildings that you saw to get these race soldiers in Georgia arrested. They were hiding the videotape in Ahmaud Arbery's case. You know, this white supremacist was hiding that. Like, come on. You think that these people are going to arrest their own kind of when they're eating and sleeping with each other? Come on. So I guess, you know, we as black people have to stop being naive about thinking that we're going to get justice from the system. It takes media, a whole type of protest. It takes a huge, huge just interfaith attitude and making sure that we work it out in order to solve the case. And that has been virtually the real issue. That was really a painful situation because at the time, you know, you had a lot of stuff going on in the media. But when it got to, like I said, this year where police brutality, the perfect time because all of these cases are now coming out. You see on the news that even if you Google, well, back in 2015, this officer did that to me. 2017, that officer did this to me. You see it all coming out now. You see what we've been saying in 2011 and 12 is now materializing in 2020. You see the time that black people now are at the boiling point where they're sick and tired of police corruption and brutality. They're killing their kids, getting shot and killed. And you got a lot of Negroes out here talking about, well, you know, what about black or black violence? You know, I mean, and I tell them all the time that white-on-black violence is what fuels black-on-black violence. I tell them that all the time. Oh, what you mean, bro? You know, what you talking about, you know? So you have Negroes out like that. You got them wanting to be involved with, okay. All right, so I'm going off the air on my Blog Talk radio show, but hold on, I will stay about 5 more minutes on Facebook podcast. All right, so I want to thank you all for tuning in to the Lawyer Henderson podcast show. We're going to continue with the Facebook conversation here, and this episode will be uploaded in about 5 minutes, give it 5 minutes, and it will be uploaded. All right, thank you all for tuning in. Let's see.